If it's 6 p.m. on a Thursday, that means it's time for Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM, WDIY.org, and our WDIY app. And we start off with Perspectives with John Pierce. Our topic this evening is the author C.S. Lewis. And I have two guests who are very much C.S. Lewis fans. And it just happens that both of them are pastors. Reverend Nick Malazzo from Hope Springs Community of Faith. And then John Hinesohn, Reverend and pastor at Community Presbyterian Church in Mount Bethel. So, C.S. Lewis, he is an Irish lad to begin with, born in Belfast in 1898. And did he spend more time in England than in Ireland, as it turns out?
He did, yeah, certainly, by the end of his life, a lot more time.
Okay. And then he died in Oxford in 1963 on the very same day that John Kennedy was... Right.
JFK and I believe Aldous Huxley, all three died that day.
All that day.
Yeah.
Wow. So let's go to your interest, both of you, in C.S. Lewis. Nick, what turned you on about C.S. Lewis?
You know, initially I found C.S. Lewis just because a lot of my friends were reading him and talking about him, and new to the faith at that time. And one of the men that was really kind of mentoring me that way would often quote Lewis and refer to Lewis. And so I started reading him, would have been early my university days, so right around 20 or so. Loved him immediately. Found him fascinating and eye-opening, and I feel like he partly mentored me, that he taught me how to think in a lot of ways. Watching him work through problems and seeing how he thought through stuff taught me how to think. And so,
do you remember the first book that you tried?
First book I tried was Mere Christianity, because that's the one that everybody talks about and everyone reads outside of Narnia, which is probably his most popular books. I liked it. It wasn't instantly my favorite. It's a great book, and I think, again, one of the most popular, but it's still not my favorite thing by him. When I think about why I love Lewis, Mere Christianity isn't the first book that comes to mind.
And John Hinesohn, you have something to say about that, too.
Yeah, I was introduced to Mere Christianity when I was in college. Someone had recommended it, but it did not take with me. I gave up on it, and it was years later, as a pastor, took a second look, found that there are really helpful things there. So I started to use it in my new member classes for those who were interested in
Yes, and that's what brings both of you here to Perspectives, is that you had a series last year on C.S. Lewis at the church of five sessions on it. And Nick, you were there too. And so we attended, and I thought, ooh, this would make an interview.
Yeah.
So, John, you were not turned on by Mere Christianity first. Right. So what brought you back to C.S. Lewis?
I think my own journey in faith, so that I was more mature and asking more questions about some of the topics he covered. I would say it's not necessarily everyone's cup of tea, but it certainly would be worth looking at if you're interested in some of the foundations of Christianity. I would say he's an apologist for the Christian faith. Bear in mind, it was written in the war years in England, a series of lectures. So there are parts that might be a little dated.
Which war?
World War II. So there are parts that might be a little dated, but the fundamental principles still are quite good.
All right. So C.S. Lewis, let's talk a little bit about his life.
Yeah. So born in Ireland, started out up around Belfast. One of the things to know about Lewis is a lot of people call him Jack. You'll hear people say Jack Lewis. And all his friends, all his family called him Jack. And when he was fairly young, 5 or 6, he apparently just marched into the kitchen and declared, his name is Jaxie. And from that point on, he just wouldn't respond to anything but Jaxie. And so the family went with it. As he got older, it got shortened to Jack. And so he just always was. And the joke is that if you had been named Clive Staples, you might have wanted to be called Jack, too.
All right. So that was a question of mine. What did the CS stand for?
Yes.
Clive Staples.
bit of a mouthful, I think, when you say it all together, though Clive's a great common name. But yeah, so Jack, to his friends and his family, you know, some, I guess, key moments in his life when he was fairly young. I think, how old was he, 8 or so? His mom passed away. That deeply impacted him and influenced him. His relationship with his father just wasn't always great after that. Father just was, kind of didn't deal with it well and was distant emotionally. And they didn't really resolve things or patch things up before his father died. Some hard relationship there, but off to boarding school at a pretty young age, in part because his mom was gone. So those early days in Ireland were super important to him, not only with his mom passing, but his piles and piles of books, I guess. His dad bought every book he ever read, and there was no limits on what they were allowed to pull down and read. He said some of those books a kid his age shouldn't have been reading, but he and his brother would make up these imaginary worlds and hide in the wardrobe. He would disappear for a day, and they would find him in the wardrobe that appears later in Narnia, and he'd have a pile of books and a pile of strawberry jam sandwiches. He'd spend a whole summer day in there.
He was a reader.
Yeah, yeah. But off to boarding school, which he writes about quite a bit in Surprised by Joy, like abusive sort of experiences there. And his brother had a much better time with it, who's a couple years older than him, than he did going through. And their experience there was quite a bit different. But one of his teachers probably was mentally ill and would take these great running gallops across the room to smack the boys with a ruler or a yardstick. And boarding school, not great. But then he got sent off to study with a tutor to prepare him for Oxford, a man named Kirkpatrick, who they referred to as the Great Knock, I believe. That for him was a bit of heaven. He still describes his days there as his ideal day, which is reading and walking and sandwiches and tea. He flourished there. Went off to World War I, came back and enrolled in Oxford, and then went on to become a scholar and a professor, classics and I think Renaissance literature, but new medieval literature very well too, certainly. So,
yeah, and as far as his faith, he was confirmed a Christian at the normal age there, but a few years later he rejected that, became, I think he was actually an atheist. And continued to do that even during World War I. He was wounded and all, but it wasn't until years later that he became a theist, believed in God, and then eventually became a Christian. And he began to write about the Christian experience. So,
wow, from Christianity, from being confirmed as a Christian, as a young man, and then turning to atheism, and then coming back to Christianity.
Right. He dabbled a little with the occult before he began to recognize God. Yeah, it's a fascinating background.
Well, Nick and John, how many books did he write?
I looked one time. He published well over 30. He was prolific. Published a variety of things. I mean, he wrote theological works about Christianity. Most of those were for a popular audience. He wasn't a theology professor. So when he wrote things like The Problem of Pain or Mere Christianity, he wasn't writing for scholars, but for everybody. And some of those actually were radio addresses. He wrote them to give on the BBC, and then later they were turned into books. But then wrote academically on literature and philosophy, medieval literature. Has one called The Discarded Image that's about that, about how image used to be sort of central, and then it got thrown away in favor of text. And he published quite a bit that way as well. But then also fiction, the Narnia series. He wrote a series on space travel, a sort of a sci-fi series. Wrote a book called Till We Have Faces that's a retelling of the myth of Cupid. Fairly wide range of topics and subjects.
Absolutely.
One of the things I like about his writings, for example, in The Great Divorce, he doesn't use the terms heaven and hell, but he tells a story about what it could be like. And it's a fascinating story, and it's not a long story. The book is short. And when it's all done, he said, you know, it was just a dream.
What's it called?
It was The Great Divorce. And divorce is the separation that occurs in Christian thought after you die. And it's a very fascinating way to look at it. I was, and still am, very impressed with this whole concept of what happens after death and, you know, how can it be fair and so forth. Well, The Great Divorce, I think, answers that question, in my mind anyway. Others do Screwtape Letters. Very theological. What about the devil? Do you believe in a devil? Devils, aids, demons? Well, again, he doesn't dwell so much on theological terms, but he gives you an idea. Hey, What if there were such a person as a devil? What would he be saying to his demons, etc.? So it's a fascinating read, even if you don't believe in the devil or anything. Then you could just look at it as fiction. But this is typical of many of his writings. Good storyteller.
Good storyteller. What somebody who has not ever read anything by C.S. Lewis, would you recommend one to begin with?
Now, I think if you want to dip your toes into his more theological writings, his Christian writings, I think The Weight of Glory is a fantastic place to start. It's an essay, but then it usually appears in a book of the same title. And so if you could find The Weight of Glory, the essay itself is, you know, maybe a dozen pages, but it's very Lewis. Like, it's his way of thinking and presenting ideas and his theology. And so I think if you read that and you don't like it, then Lewis maybe isn't your favorite guy, but I think for a lot of people that'll hook you, that you'll go, okay, if this is what he's like, then I think I want to read some more.
Yeah. And that's Weight of Glory, W-E-I-G-H-T.
Yes, The Weight of Glory.
Weight of Glory.
Yeah. I think I might recommend The Four Loves, and he talks about it. It's a simple concept that people can grasp that might be a good beginning place for some people.
I think if you do want to read The Four Loves, I just tell you, if you look around for the audiobook, this was another one of those books that was initially a radio address. It still exists. And so it is the only high-quality recording of C.S. Lewis' voice on the planet. And you can listen to Lewis himself go through The Four Loves. And he's fun to listen to. He does have a fairly snooty British accent. He sounds like a high British scholar from the early 20th century.
Pedantic.
It is fun. He is charming. I think in his life and his writings, that's consistent, that he's just warm and charming and enjoyable. And so,
You didn't mention Irish accent.
No, that's...
That was lost, huh?
Yeah, I think was in England for so long from so young that, he really definitely has the upper-class British accent.
Our topic this evening on perspectives is the author C.S. Lewis, who lived from 1898 to 1963. My guests are two pastors who have become enthralled with C.S. Lewis's writings, and we are almost ready to take a break. John, do you have any plans to do another series on C.S. Lewis, or not at this time?
Not at this time.
Okay. And how about, have you ever tried this kind of thing that John has done, Nick, as far as a series of four or five?
I've never just done try to teach a class just on C.S. Lewis. But I've several times picked one of his books to go through with a group of people. In the course of that, you talk about him and his life and some of his other writings, too. But even youth took a bunch of high school students. We read The Great Divorce together several years ago, and they loved it. We had a lot of fun talking through each one of there's a series of vignettes of different spirits that he meets in heaven. Different spirits that are visiting heaven. Mm-hmm. And each one of them I find deeply convicting that there's not one of their problems that I don't think, oh man, I know I have that too. And you see how that's keeping them from God, keeping them from heaven. And it ended up being a lot of fun with these high school students to look at those characters.
It's time for us to take a break now. We're talking about author C.S. Lewis here on Perspectives by John Pierce. I'm your host, and our engineer this evening is James Zibrot. We'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
And we're back. I'm going to ask Reverend Nick Malazzo to tell us a little bit, or to read even some passages that he happens to like from C.S. Lewis. Reverend John Hinesohn is my other guest this evening, and we're having fun talking about this author, C.S. Lewis, who has touched your hearts, both of you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. So, I think one of my favorite things from Lewis that has really impacted my life is his description of friendship in The Four Loves. That the book title tells you what he goes through four different words in Greek that get translated to love, and he looks at each one of those. But his description of friendship, when I read that as a young man, was really formative. I put it down and I went, hey, I kind of know who my friends are and why now. And I found that really helpful. And what he says, in a nutshell, is that friendship is always your friends about something, that friends see the same truth. And he has this metaphor where he says, lovers look face to face, but friends stand side by side looking at the same thing. And it doesn't mean you're unaware of each other. You thoroughly enjoy each other's company, but you're not friends about the other person. You're friends about this shared thing. And he says, a lot of friendships begin with the words, you too? I thought I was the only one. And that's what forms a friendship. And so because of that, because friendship is about something, he says friendships then form in circles. That friendships delight to add friends who genuinely care about the same topic. And so that's why if you think about your own friends, that you'll have friends that are, you'll have different circles of friends. And some of the friends in one group will be able to join a different group and some won't, because some of them care about the same thing that other circle does and some don't.
So this explains about small groups that you have at a church or book clubs or workout buddies. All these things where you have something in common with the other person.
Yeah, and I think what he would say, and kind of does, is he goes, initially, those are like the context in which you find friends. That it starts out with you're working together on the same project, but then as you work together, you find these people within that group that see the same truth you do, care about the same thing you do. And that's where these friendships begin to form. And I think he's right that friendship is really undervalued in our culture because it's non-necessary. Without romantic love, we would cease to procreate. Without affection, we wouldn't raise kids. But you can live and die without friends and mostly feed yourself and be okay. Friendship is, it's one of those things, it's not what sustains your life, it's what gives your life meaning. It's why you sustain your life.
Right. That's a pretty sad idea, though, that you could live out your life without friends. Not romantic, but simply people who have your back, who understand you?
They care about the same thing you do. And because that does make friendships threatening as well, that because friendships form in circles, as soon as I say these are my friends, he says, I'm also saying, and all of you are not. And in a democratic society, that can sound really threatening. And in an authoritarian society, that sounds like a little group for rebellion. And so there's actually some social pressure, maybe not to form these, but because you have to remember, he says, of course you like your friends. You chose them. And the people who aren't your friends have friends who aren't you. And so you can't get too proud or cocky about it. In fact, once he does say, a circle of friends can become, it can devolve to where it's about excluding other people. But then it ceases to be a friendship.
It's a clique.
Yeah, it stops being about anything else.
Yeah.
And so the friendship dies when that happens.
Right. Brings up the question that, and I don't know if C.S. Lewis approaches this, but the difference between acquaintances and friends. I contend that we have many acquaintances, but we don't have very many friends. If we have one or two friends, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. It might be a spouse and someone else, or a couple of people that you know really well, deep friendship. But very often from the pulpit, my friends, I don't think so.
The term could get, bandied about a little too loosely. And I think Lewis would agree. I mean, I think he would say the love that we have for acquaintances, he would call affection. And that affection and friendship often go together. You're going to have affection for friends, especially old friends. But that's not what makes you friends, that your friendship is about this shared truth, this shared interest. And so within the circle, it's democratic, that each man just stands or woman just stands for themselves, that you bring yourself to the table, that because it's not about you, you're to some extent, your social status or your those things don't matter, because the friendship is about something else. That was helpful to me, that I was able to look and say, hey, here's my friends, and here's what we're friends about. You know, if you think about your friends, you talk about the same six or eight things all the time, and you never get bored. And other people who aren't part of that circle go, ah, they're talking about that again. and he says, in a real circle, then what happens is each member delights in each other member of the circle. So that, you know, if the three of us are part of a circle of friends, there's parts of you that I'm only going to see when John's in the room. And there's parts of me that you're only going to see when John's in the room. And so if we lose John to our circle, not only do we lose John and his input, but we lose his part of each one of us. And so the whole circle is enriched or diminished by each person who joins it.
Interesting, huh?
Yeah.
If you want a passage, this is Lewis's description of a circle of friends, and I find it warm and deeply compelling. And this is what he says. In a perfect friendship, this appreciative love is, I think, often so great and so firmly based that each member of the circle feels, in his secret heart, humbled before all the rest. Sometimes he wonders what he is doing there among his betters. He is lucky beyond desert to be in such company, especially when the whole group is together, each bringing out all that is best, wisest, or funniest in all the others. Those are the golden sessions, when four or five of us, after a hard day's walking, have come to our inn, when our slippers are on, our feet spread out towards the blaze, and our drinks at our elbows, when the whole world, and something beyond the world, opens itself to our minds as we talk. And no one has any claim or any responsibility for another, but all are freemen and equals, as if we had first met an hour ago, while at the same time an affection, mellowed by the years, enfolds us. Life, natural life, has no better gift to give. Who could have deserved it?
Beautiful, huh?
Yes, right on.
And English, too, after a day's, and I thought he was going to say work, and he says, after a day's...
Walking. Lewis, he was an avid walker. He loved to walk, went on long walks, especially as a young man, all the time, walked with friends.
He talks about the slippers at the end of the day and a drink. It sounds so English.
He did. Loved a walking tour and then find an inn to put up at the end of the day and get up the next day and keep on walking.
So that's a book, and then again, the title is
The Four Loves.
The Four Loves by C.S. Lewis. And what's another book that draws your attention particularly?
You know, The Problem of Pain, I think, is a lot of fun as well.
Oh.
It doesn't sound it, does it?
No, it doesn't. Pain, go away.
Yeah. And, you know, he has two books that probably directly deal with human suffering. This is the one where he's rational and kind of thinking through it intellectually. But he has another one called A Grief Observed that he wrote when his wife died. That one is raw and emotional. Lewis, still very thoughtful, but it is kind of an edited and compiled version, I think, of the notes he sketched out as he mourned and missed his wife after she
died.
And
that's called?
A Grief Observed.
And the one that you have in your hands right now is called?
This one's called The Problem of Pain. And so here he asks kind of the old theological question, how can God be good and there still be suffering and evil in the world? He puts it this way, if God were good, he would wish to make his creatures perfectly happy. And if God were almighty, he would be able to do what he wished. But the creatures are not happy. Therefore, God lacks either goodness or power, or both. I believe he's quoting there, but that frames up the question.
That sounds right.
Really
to me.
Pretty well, yeah. And of course, there have been volumes written on that question, and it's not one with a simple or pat answer. Lewis, I think, takes a pretty good swing at it. One of the ways he begins is just by saying, a nonsense question is still a nonsense question, even if it's about God. So the question, if God can do anything, could he make a rock so big that he couldn't lift it? Is just bad logic. You've set up the parameters at the beginning that God could do anything and then asked if he could do something that he can't do. And so it's kind of a nonsense question. And he says, to a certain extent, this is similar, that what you're really saying is, what I want is for God to make us cognitive, rational beings with the ability to choose, persons. but to take away from us the opportunity to choose anything he doesn't want us to choose. You want God to make beings who have a choice but don't have a choice. And it doesn't work out rationally. It doesn't work out logically. It's just, it doesn't make sense when you kind of look at what you're really asking for there.
So how does free will play into that?
It's part of it, yeah.
So, I mean, if we have free will, that means that God is not controlling all of our thoughts.
Or actions or decisions. Right. But for them to be real thoughts, real actions, real decisions, they have to come with actual consequences. What Lewis goes on to say, I think this is fascinating, really, is that so the bare minimum requirements to make a person, a rational, cognitive person, for God to make you and for you to know yourself to exist and to know God to exist and to know that you are not God, that you're not just this big amorphous gloop, that you are there and God is there. Because that would be the minimum sort of allowable requirements. And he goes, then you would have one choice, yourself or God. And that would be it. And of course, that's not the world that God chose to make, but that would be kind of the basic. And so when God then creates us as beings to kind of exist, we have to know ourselves as separate from all the other beings that are around us. And so we have to know them, and we have to know ourselves, and we have to know that we aren't them and they aren't us. And so in order for that to work, there has to be this sort of mediating environment, what we would call the world. And for the world to do its job, it has to work by fairly set rules or laws. So the thing that separates us is the thing that brings us together. The fact that you are you and I am me, and we can't really get inside each other's heads, also means that I can know you as a person, and you can know me as a person. And the thing that makes that possible is the world between us that works generally on basic laws, right? So if shoes just randomly flew through the air, and I was sitting here and one of your shoes just hit me, I would just think, I don't know what that means. That doesn't mean anything. But because we live in a world where shoes don't randomly fly through the air, if I'm sitting here and one of your shoes hits me in the head, I think, one of you guys is upset with me, yeah. Right? Because here you just threw your shoe at me and hit me in the head. And so, but what that means, though, then, is that it's impossible that that world should be satisfactory to all of us equally at all times. And some of the things that you choose to do with that world, I'm going to find distasteful. And some of the things that I do, you might find distasteful. And you might throw your shoe at me for good reason, and I might not like getting hit in the head with it. And so if you take all that away, right, if you say, okay, guys, I make a world where only good things are possible, where your choices don't really play out or matter, we can't even be persons. I can't know you, and I can't know me. I never really know whether you are doing good to me because you care about me or because you just don't have a choice.
Just a closing thought. I think C.S. Lewis is a varied writer, and because of his experiences in life, he can appeal to many different people. Those who are going through grief will find some of his writings at the end very helpful. But you got the children's literature and so many other things that we've just talked about. And today, there are opportunities to get into his writings in June in Philadelphia. What is it, Max McLean? We'll do a presentation of C.S. Lewis's life, et cetera, further up and further in. There are many C.S. Lewis societies around the world.
Oh, I didn't
and,
know that.
And yes, Christians particularly are quite interested in this fellow who is an apologist for the Christian faith and is able to express himself very well, but also experienced all the things that, or many of the things that you and I experience in life. So I just wanted to share that there's a lot that we haven't gone into, but is part of his life and work.
Well, there we are, folks. Our program this evening on C.S. Lewis and my guests. I thank you very much, Reverend John Hinesohn of the Community Presbyterian Church in Mount Bethel, and Nick Malazzo, pastor of Home Springs Community of Faith. Thanks so much for coming over to WDIY, and welcome to our microphones.
Well, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It was a lot of fun. And we thank our engineer this evening, James Zibrot, and most of all, we thank you listeners for tuning in. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.
If you enjoyed this program, please go to the WDIY website or app to share or become a WDIY member.